Brilliant novels, groundbreaking nonfiction, evocative poetry, great books, and insightful conversations whenever you want them on the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast. Pick the books that speak to you or read them all. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with Karen Kodrowski, director of the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Women and Politics at Iowa State University in Ames. Karen, nice to have you back with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Megan Goldberg joining us as well, assistant professor of American politics at Cornell College in Mount Vernon. Megan, always nice to have you as well. Thank you.
Nice to be here, Ben.
And we want to invite our listeners this hour as we go through a half dozen topics to join our conversation. If you haven't jotted this number down near your wherever you are, please do. This is our call-in number, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. You can also email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I want to talk about an announcement by a Republican state lawmaker this week, a little later in the hour. He threw the state senator threw his hat in the ring for Senator Grassley's seat. Now, Senator Grassley hasn't said yet whether he'll seek an eighth term in 2022. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Also, we'll get into some more post-impeachment verdict aftermath. Lots of things there to discuss with Karen and Megan. Also, President Biden's efforts to increase the rate of vaccinations and that economic stimulus package being worked on by Congress. But first of all, the breaking news within the last hour. We heard it from NPR there just now. Rush Limbaugh has died, this provocative voice of conservative America, dominating talk radio for more than three decades, often attacking liberals, Democrats, feminists, environmentalists. A lot of targets he had. Karen, comment on what you see as his legacy in American politics. It would be hard to overstate his influence, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. He, I think, galvanized many people on the right. He gave voice to what a lot of people were thinking and feeling. He helped his followers to frame issues and understand things. You know, he was at one point one of the chief advocates of the birther rumor that President Obama was not born in the United States. And I think without a high-profile advocate such as Limbaugh, it wouldn't have caught the attention of Donald Trump. It wouldn't have caught the attention of millions of Americans. And it would not then have had the legs and the durability that it had, where, you know, it took a long time before that particular myth was effectively and conclusively debunked.
Mm-hmm. And I think you can trace the beginning of his career back to the late 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president. If you really want to go to the roots of it, the FCC then getting rid of what was called the Fairness Doctrine, which some of our older listeners will certainly remember, and that opened the doors to have the kind of discussions that Rush Limbaugh pioneered. Megan Goldberg, your comment on the death and legacy of Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, you know, I want to echo, I think, everything Karen has said, and sort of what you just said, that, you know, I think he had enormous influence on individuals who listened to him, but I think also an enormous influence on basically the landscape we see in media today. You know, it seems like things, commentary, conservative or liberal, is such a part of the landscape today. But it is still relatively new, and he was one of, you know, talk radio was sort of the place where we first saw that emergence. And so, you know, not just his influence on individual people and voters, but an influence on how we get information, what information we get, and all of that is obviously, of course, traced to, as you mentioned, the Fairness Doctrine as well.
Mm-hmm. And Karen, back to you, because Rush Limbaugh is no longer on the airwaves, it doesn't mean his type of voice, his views are not represented out there. There's plenty of voices similar to his.
Oh, yeah.
Now.
There have been a number of other talk radio hosts that have come out with, you know, from particularly on the conservative perspective, they came to dominate the AM radio. And Limbaugh almost single-handedly sort of resurrected what was thought to be a dying medium, which was AM radio, which, you know, had been losing listeners to FM radio, where the sound quality was so much better, but AM was very well suited to kind of the long format talk. And then there were a lot of sort of other kind of Me Too hosts who came along that were in the same ilk. But also we see that it contributed, I think, to the creation of Fox News and to a lesser degree MSNBC, both of which are highly popular cable news networks and that very freely merge the reporting of news with the interpretation and the opinion on the news. And, you know, if you ever want to have a good example of when public policy matters, right, the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine opened the gates to this kind of reporting, which is more common than other countries than what it was in the United States.
Someone pointed out to me a few years ago, this is data from a few years ago, but it stuck in my mind, and you'll know why. We were looking at the audience numbers for Morning Edition on NPR nationwide. At that point, they were roughly equal to Rush Limbaugh's nationwide audience for Morning Edition compared to one person, Rush Limbaugh. Of course, do not understate the influence that he had. Let's move on, though, to some of the other political items on our landscape. Let's talk about President Biden's trip yesterday to Milwaukee, to Wisconsin, pitching his $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief plan at a CNN town hall event. Let's listen to a little clip from him. When asked about availability, Biden said anybody who wanted a vaccine would be able to get one this summer.
By the end of July of this year, when we came into office, there was only 50 million doses that are available. We have now, by the end of July, we'll have over 600 million doses, enough to vaccinate every single American.
Megan Goldberg, President Biden has been in office for roughly a month. One of his pledges was to make tackling this coronavirus his number one priority. How's he doing? And I don't know if you caught much of that town hall yesterday, but comment.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's this, especially on the topic of vaccines, right? The problem is two-dimensional, really, in a lot of ways, that there is the problem of supply, which it seems like, you know, they have been effective at acquiring more doses. And that's obviously needed. That's a necessary condition to get vaccinations. You know, but I think he also pointed out during the town hall that getting them administered is sort of a whole nother beast. And I think that's where we see across the country huge inequalities in what states are doing a good job at delivering vaccines, which states are failing to do so. And so I think that's a piece where we haven't seen as much federal leadership, that states are sort of being forced to figure it out themselves, the administration piece, or in some cases, you know, punting it to counties or cities to figure out how to administer these doses. So I think if we look on those two dimensions, we see some successes and some failures.
Mm-hmm. Well, away from that, his Vice President, Kamala Harris, was in an interview in NBC's Today show this morning. She says teachers should be a priority for vaccination.
Teachers should be a priority. Look, let me just tell you something. I love teachers. My first grade teacher, Mrs. Frances Wilson, attended my law school graduation. Teachers are critical to our children's development. They should be able to teach in a safe place and expand the minds and the opportunities of our children. So teachers should be a priority along with other frontline workers, and we're going to make them a priority.
Okay, Karen Kodrowski, your take on the first month under Biden and this new approach to tackling the coronavirus epidemic.
Well, I think that we are all looking forward to politics becoming boring again, which, you know, the fact that the Biden administration has been able to move forward with anything at all in spite of, you know, insurrection and impeachment and the impeachment trial and all of those other things going on, that we're almost in the debate over the stimulus bill and the debate over vaccines. We're beginning to see the parties sort of sort themselves out into the usual camps, right? We hear the Republicans talking about concerns about the cost of the stimulus plan. We hear a lot of discussion about whether and how schools should be reopened and, you know, whether or not mask mandates work. There's almost a sense of normalcy that's coming along here.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the stimulus plan that you mentioned. House Democrats finalizing the details of that $1.9 trillion economic relief package. Final legislation, from what I read, due at the end of next week. In its current form, though, the legislation would provide billions of dollars for schools, small businesses, bolster unemployment benefits through the fall, and deliver a round of about $1,400 direct payments to individuals and provide for a gradual increase in the federal minimum wage to $15. Now, that was a point of discussion. Before I have you comment, Megan, on this economic stimulus that is being crafted, let's listen to President Biden in that same town hall yesterday evening in Wisconsin, stressing the need to pass this a relief package of the scale and size of this one.
There is a consensus among economists, left, right, and center. In order to grow the economy a year, two, three, and four down the line, we can't spend too much. Now's the time we should be spending. Now's the time to go big. It is estimated that if we pass this bill alone, we'll create 7 million jobs this year.
Okay, Megan, it is thought that the Democrats do not need Republicans to pass the stimulus. Will there be any sort of bipartisan nature of that? Is that something that you see as a possibility, as desirable by the Democrats?
You know, I think there's a lot of rhetoric right now about the importance of unity and bipartisanship. And that's not necessarily new, but I think one thing the Biden administration has done, in particular his press secretary, is reframe how we sort of think about this, because it might not seem bipartisan when we look at the votes in Congress. But the reality sort of on the ground in the U.S. is that especially these direct payments to individuals have huge numbers of support. And that Americans broadly are immensely supportive of individual stimulus payments. And so if you can sort of shift how we think about bipartisanship, it really is bipartisan when you have support of Americans on both sides of the aisle. So I think that's where we'll see the Biden administration sort of focusing on how this is a policy supported by Americans. Let's put aside for a second Congress and leaders and think about, you know, people that this is actually going to help and frame it that way to see that bipartisanship.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the bipartisan possibility here, Karen?
I think Megan is right that it'll be hard to incentivize Republicans to work with Democrats, other than, you know, maybe a few of the more moderates who might come over and vote in favor of a package. But having said that, there are certain governors that are supportive of the Biden administration. Certainly the Biden administration is going to be interested in working with governors on things like vaccination and school reopening and so forth. So I think that they're going to, you know, redefine bipartisanship as something other than the final vote in Congress, just as Megan said.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, it's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer with Karen Kodrowski of Iowa State University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, our two political scientists for this edition of our program. Just to wrap up that discussion of the pandemic-related politics, a new Quinnipiac poll out this morning. Americans approving 58% to 32% of the way Biden is handling the response to the coronavirus. On the handling of the economy, they approved 48% to 39%. Of course, there's a partisan divide there. We don't need to get into that at this point. I want to move on to Saturday. Was it only a few days ago that we had this Senate trial come to an end with the acquittal of Donald Trump for the charge of inciting the article of impeachment, inciting the mob that stormed the Capitol last month, an insurrection that left five people dead, forced lawmakers to flee, put his own vice president in danger, all during the certification of Democrat Joe Biden's election win? Let me ask the two of you your takeaways from this second impeachment trial and verdict. Megan, you first, please.
You know, I think putting aside, you know, there are some questions about whether or not it would have been helpful for either side to have witnesses, for the American people to have witnesses. I think this really calls into question the future of impeachment generally. You know, this was, even though it doesn't seem like it, a bipartisan impeachment. But on the other hand, right, it seems quite, the evidence was quite stark, and we even heard McConnell after the vote basically giving a defense of voting guilty instead of to acquit. And so I think there are some real questions about what does the power of impeachment really mean going forward after this? And is it actually a check on presidential power?
Mm-hmm. To throw in another quote there, Senator Lindsey Graham on Sunday morning on Fox News, this quote, Lindsey Graham, "I don't know how Kamala Harris doesn't get impeached if the Republicans take over the House." Wow, a glimpse into the future. Could this be part of our new normal? Karen, do you see it as a possible?
I certainly think that it's possible. When you think about it, right, this is the fifth impeachment that has happened, and there was almost a century between the first one and the second one with Andrew Johnson and Richard Nixon. And then since then, it looks, you know, we've had them with increasing frequency. So then 20 years later, Bill Clinton, and then, 20 years later, too, for Donald Trump. So, but in between that, we see that there have been impeachment resolutions that have been introduced fairly regularly into Congress, like, for example, one against George W. Bush over the, you know, Iraq War, for example. There were discussions about impeachment of Reagan over Iran-Contra that just didn't go very far. So impeachment is a political process, but not just in the ways that we heard it. It's political in that it is also a way for people to express dismay at administration policies that they might not have any other way to control, right? And so, you know, it becomes a symbolic political statement. And of course, we've already seen that Marjorie Taylor Greene introduced an impeachment resolution against Biden for Hunter Biden's involvement with Ukraine or something. So it can be just a way of sort of expressing opposition to the president. I think what we've also seen, though, in this latest impeachment trial, as well as in Bill Clinton's impeachment trial, is some frustration that the Constitution only allows for one punishment on the part of the Senate. They can remove somebody from office, or they can acquit, right? But there's nothing else that they can do, like, you know, censure or, you know, and of course, the prohibition from seeking office again is contingent upon being removed from office. So, you know, there's no censure, there's no fine, there's, you know, no other possible remedy that they can pursue. And so that, you know, there was, I think, pretty widespread disdain of Bill Clinton's behavior, which many people found appalling, but didn't think that it merited removal from office. And of course, in this case with President Trump, the dilemma was that he was already out of office. So what does a vote to remove him from office really do, right? Even if and it allowed the Republicans who might have condemned his behavior, such as Mitch McConnell, to say that, that there was a constitutional question because he was already out of office. It gave them an out to vote to acquit.
Let's hear a little bit of Mitch McConnell, because that was really an amazing speech he gave right after voting to acquit one of the 43 GOP senators, including our U.S. senators here in Iowa, Grassley and Ernst, voting to acquit. Mitch McConnell, in a several-minute speech on the floor of the Senate, really a scathing indictment of the president. Here are almost a minute of his speech on the Senate floor a few days ago.
He was watching the same live television as the rest of us. A mob was assaulting the Capitol in his name. These criminals were carrying his banners, hanging his flags, and screaming their loyalty to him. It was obvious that only President Trump could end this. He was the only one who could.
Well, now, yesterday, as you might expect, the former president, Donald Trump, attacked McConnell, calling him, quote, a dour, sullen, and unsmiling political hack, stating if Republican senators are going to stay with him, they will not win again. It's a some 600-word statement. No contrition from Donald Trump in this statement for his role in the deadly January 6th riot. Megan, so this really, in two people, Trump and McConnell, points to the divide in the Republican Party. How do you see this developing going forward?
You know, I think one thing we might see is that this battle is going to move to states. Because I think in some states, right, the future of the Republican Party is not Trumpism. And Republicans in those states, I think, recognize that. But in many states, you know, I think Iowa is arguably one of them, that is the way forward for the Republican Party if what you care about is your, you know, electoral viability. And so, you know, I think we see that playing out in Iowa right now in terms of the policies the state is pursuing, that it's really a continuation of Trump's agenda in many ways. And you see that in other states as well. And with states, you know, of the few senators who did vote to convict Trump, we see them being censored by their parties. And so, you know, I think that this battle is going to move to states, and it's going to depend on the political conditions in that state as well.
Mm-hmm. Megan, your comment reminds me of the headline of a New York Times opinion piece I heard this morning. Let me quote it. If there was a Republican civil war, it appears to be over. The party belongs to Trump for as long as he wants it. Karen, very quickly, we have to go away in 30 seconds. Do you agree?
No, I think that that's still very much an open question, because there are two active factions in the Republican Party. They're both talking about splitting away and creating separate parties, and it will be interesting to see how that plays out.
Indeed, it will. We'll be back after a short break. Karen Kodrowski with us of Iowa State University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, our two political scientists on board this edition of our Politics Wednesday, River to River. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. We'll continue to talk about the future of the GOP when we return. Also, this Republican state lawmaker, state senator, who threw his hat in the ring for Senator Grassley's seat in 2022. We'll ask our analysts what that may mean when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more of River to River in just a moment from Iowa Public Radio News.
The way Iowans consume news has changed a lot since the coronavirus pandemic hit in 2020. But people here still need to know what's going on in the state every day. What are leaders saying?
The virus isn't going away until we have a vaccine.
How are medical professionals reacting, and how is it affecting hospital staff and schools?
Those weekends where you are on the phone and sending emails and, you know, dealing with people with a very emotional issue. has been really hard.
I'm Clay Masters. In 2021, Iowa Public Radio is starting a podcast called Hear First. It's a quick daily show for your work week that catches you up on state news as you begin your day. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters.
Most of the improvement in the unemployment picture comes from more than 90,000 Iowans no longer looking for work.
Find out when high-profile politicians are in the state.
Back at the state fair!
Learn about what's going on in state government and discover Iowans you might not hear about otherwise.
This is the first time I have spoken with a woman without documents who's also unafraid of sharing her story on the radio.
Subscribe to Iowa Public Radio's Hear First wherever you get your podcasts.
So good to have you on board on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on the program, we've been hearing in our news that Iowa has been struggling to increase its vaccination rates. Tomorrow, we'll focus on vaccine distribution and access in the state. Also, a snapshot of the immunization campaign in one of Iowa's 99 counties, Washington County, we picked out. And we'll invite you to join our conversation as well. It's Politics Wednesday. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. With us today, Karen Kodrowski of Iowa State University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, as we work our way through the many developments on the political landscape. Of course, in our news as well, the aftermath of the January 7th attack on the U.S. Capitol this week. Iowa angle on this. Federal prosecutors filing new charges against the Des Moines man accused of breaching the U.S. Capitol on that day. This is the one wearing the QAnon shirt, leading the angry mob toward the lone black officer during the raid. The Senate voting last week unanimously to award that officer, Eugene Goodman, a Congressional Gold Medal for steering the rioters away from lawmakers. A new poll out today, Megan and Karen, I don't know if you saw it, the new ABC Ipsos poll, over half of Americans say that former President Trump should have been convicted. Talk about what you're seeing here, because the verdict is one only one render of, a judgment on the former president. Polls are another way. Megan, how do you see Donald Trump's role and his role in his presidency will be viewed in history?
You know, so I think that this is one that I sort of want to see how things play out, because at the same time, polls, which is, you know, I can't believe we're already talking about 2024, but Trump is also leading the polls in terms of who should be the next Republican nominee. So, you know, that even if a majority of Americans supported, the other outcome, he does still have support in the party. And so I think, there are some damning aspects of this legacy. And I think that, you know, the insurrection is not something that will ever go away. I think that will be in our history books connected to him. But I don't know, I think it's an open question, as Karen noted right before the break, that I don't know that his role is necessarily over yet. And so I think there's still the potential that he's going to sort of come and either, you know, try to launder the reputation, especially from the last year in office, or that he's going to play a continued role in the party and that he's still building a legacy.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Congress this week, she said Congress would create an independent panel modeled after the 9/11 commission to investigate the failures that allowed rioters to invade the Capitol. Karen, what is your thoughts here? Is this the best approach? The 9/11 commission, to my mind, and in reading about it in recent days, had a tremendous bipartisan approach and was lauded for its findings.
Well, and there have been other commissions like, you know, the Tower Commission that investigated the Iran-Contra hearings, for example. There was a commission that investigated Bill Clinton's behavior in the White House. So these commissions have a fairly long history, and I think that they are an important way to carefully document things that occurred. And they become really the first history of these crucial events that happen in our, you know, as part of our collective memory. And so I think being able to have a commission that, you know, is able to really dive into some of the issues, to do it without the press of legislation that you would find if it was to be done through, say, congressional hearings or congressional investigation, is a good first step. And I think also that these commissions can also help people have, you know, can lead to changes in public policy and help people to be able to heal from the trauma of the events.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about news here out of Iowa. The challenger, the Iowa State Senator, James Carlin, a Republican from Sioux City, announcing this week he will be running for U.S. Senate, vying for the seat currently held by Senator Chuck Grassley. Grassley, 87 years old, not announced yet whether he'll seek an eighth term. Yes, I said an eighth term in the U.S. Senate. Those are six-year terms. James Carlin, Senator, State Senator Carlin, saying he's very concerned about the direction of the country. Some quotes here. I think we have lost. We have a cause for concern. Are we free today? What have your legislators done on national and state levels? The moment he lost the election, referring to former President Trump, they took away his free speech on every media platform immediately. On the Biden certification, another quote from him, many of us believe, and I am one of those people, that our last election was the result of widespread fraud that never got a fair hearing, Carlin said. He said representative government never got a fair hearing. Megan, comment on this entry. We don't know where his candidacy will go. We don't know if what the intentions are of Senator Grassley. Certainly a lot of road before we get to a point where he would need to make a decision. What do you think of this entry, though?
You know, I think this is, you know, we've talked about the direction of the Republican Party going forward, and I think that his announcement and really all of that commentary is an indication of where he thinks the Republican Party is going and should go, especially when it comes to the electorate in Iowa. That, you know, we and there have been calls over the past weeks, over the past months, for Republican members of Congress to make statements, basically, that this election was free and fair, that Joe Biden is a legitimate president, and to be very clear that there was not evidence of widespread voter fraud, and that all of these accusations have not yielded any real evidence. And but we see at the same time members of Congress who are still actively peddling those theories. And there's a lot of concern, I think, fairly, that what happens to the democratic process when one party refuses to believe that it's happening, I suppose, and that there's lots of Republicans who are not, you know, they don't think that's their direction of the party, but that this is, you know, that this is representative of that particular direction.
Mm-hmm. Karen, do you think there's any end in sight? Do you see an end possible for constituencies for candidates that rest on these patently false claims, such as Biden was not elected in a free and fair election, that claims of widespread voting fraud get traction, even though there is not an ounce of evidence to support that?
Well, I think that some of the thought leaders on the Republican side, I mean, it'll have to be an overwhelming number of the leadership that repudiates these beliefs. And also, I think over time that we really need to be focusing on civics education and critical thinking so that people can actually begin to sniff out on their own, you know, conspiracy theories or baseless claims as opposed to those that are valuable. Now, one thing that I thought that was interesting about Mr. Carlin's announcement is that it sounds like he's running against Joe Biden, not that he's running against Senator Grassley. And he also did not, you know, announce that he was going to be challenging Grassley in a primary. He simply announced that he was a candidate for Senate. So I think that, you know, he's trying to thread a needle here. He's trying to get, you know, start getting his name out and building support should Senator Grassley announce that he is not going to be be a candidate for re-election, and then he will have had a leg up on any other aspirants for that seat. And I think that there would be a lot of potential candidates who would like to run for the U.S. Senate if Senator Grassley chooses to step aside.
Mm-hmm. Karen, would you like to mention any names? Have you heard any names mentioned? Should
no,
Senator Grassley? Not going to go there right now.
Not right now.
Okay. But your interesting point about we live in a digital age full of all kinds of social media, and it's rapidly evolving. Can we, Megan, pick up on that point? Can we rise to the occasion with this new social media and our silos of news that many of us find ourselves in to get a more healthy evaluation of what is fact and what is fiction?
Yeah, you know, and that's, as you know, Karen, I'm sure can attest to this as college professors, that's what we try to do every day. But I think there are paths forward, certainly. And I think another interesting aspect, and you know, is that social media sort of gets played as like the boogeyman a lot and certainly contributes to the problem. But you know, in terms of where people get information, cable news outlets are also a huge perpetrator of these untruths. And so I think one thing that we have seen, and it'll be interesting to see how this continues to play out, is basically how legal challenges to that misinformation, how those go in those media outlets with like Dominion and other voting technology companies suing Fox News and other networks for defamation. And so, and that, you know, does that have an actual effect of sort of restraining the things they say on air? Because those networks are hugely influential. And even some of the information, if misinformation is being spread on social media, oftentimes it comes from those sources to begin with, right? It's clips from Fox News sort of circulating about the election, or clips from Newsmax circulating.
Mm-hmm. Karen, do you think that's a possible corrective measure?
Yes, I do. I think actually, yeah, I think that's a great idea. And I think there's another point that I would like to make that's worth saying, too, is that Senator Carlin, you know, was saying that, you know, President Trump's free speech has been abridged because he has been kicked off of social media platforms. Constitutionally, that is not the case at all. You know, the Constitution protects us from the government being able to punish particularly unpopular forms of speech. It doesn't have anything to do with access to using the platform that's owned by a private company. Now, I think there are some legitimate questions about whether a private company should have as much power as they do, and whether or not they should be regulated in some way. But absolutely, positively, you know, there was no, you know, constitutional abridgment of President Trump's freedom of speech. And moreover, he has been able to express himself, right? He's been using email, right? How 2006, right? But he has been able to use email to send out, you know, his positions on things. And so he is still able to express himself and to make himself heard. And I'm sure that he would be a welcome guest on, you know, various conservative radio talk shows if he was interested in using that medium.
Right. But since being banned from Twitter and Facebook, Karen, it's changed the landscape, not having sometimes dozens of tweets per day from Donald
Trump.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So the agenda setting function that he enjoyed, where, you know, there was just all this coverage of what he was tweeting right now, has really been replaced with, you know, with, and again, I want to say sort of normal politics, right? You know, what bills are coming up in Congress, and, you know, what are the Republicans saying about, you know, President Biden and things like that? It's a much quieter and less dramatic, you know, news reporting cycle now.
Karen, as director of the Carrie Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at ISU, I wanted to get your view on this, especially, of course, Megan's view as well, this story that broke this morning in the New York Times, that there will be two female generals, promotions for female generals delayed over fears of the former president's reaction. Let me just read a first two paragraphs of the New York Times article. Last fall, the Pentagon's most senior leaders agreed that two top generals should be promoted to elite four-star commands. For then-Defense Secretary Mark Esper and General Mark A. Milley, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the tricky part was that both of the accomplished officers were women. In 2020, America under President Trump, the two Pentagon leaders feared that any candidates other than white men for the jobs mostly held by white men might run into turmoil once their nominations got to the White House. I don't know if you had time to read this story, Karen, but fascinating here as it pertains to women in leadership positions.
Yes, and I did read the article, and I had two reactions. Number one is that I thought, well, it's wonderful that these women are now going to probably receive their richly deserved promotions, and that's great, you know, to see women at, you know, at the highest levels of government, the military and business is good for our country. Diversity is good for our country, and it's wonderful in terms of role modeling for, you know, younger women and young girls who might be interested in similar kinds of careers. At the same time, I was absolutely horrified. I was horrified that there was this delay, and I think the fears of the Pentagon were probably, you know, valid, that there would have been a greater injustice done to these women if their names had gone up in a timely fashion, because then they might not have gotten the promotions at all. But you know, the delay is not without its cost, right? There's less time in rank for these women. It'll have an impact on their pensions, and it will have an impact on, you know, what kind of changes or, you know, opportunities they might have in the future within the military. So the military has suffered from the delay in this, and the women themselves have suffered due to the delay.
Right,
but,
Karen,
you know, they had the Pentagon had a Hobson's choice.
Right. And according to this New York Times reporting, Esper and Milley worried that if they even raised their names back when Donald Trump was president, the White House would replace them with their own candidates before leaving office. What are your thoughts in this news report, Megan?
You're right. I think everything Karen said, I absolutely agree with. And I also think, you know, it's this, we know that there's this dynamic, particularly among women, who might be interested in pursuing leadership roles, that they often think they need to be more qualified than their male counterparts. They need to have, you know, basically everything that their male counterparts have, but more. And there's this, you know, part of that is a fear that their gender is going to affect their ability to do their job. And I think it's really a shame that that basically they see their fear splashed on the New York Times. So I think, you know, obviously Karen has done a really good job of the cost, material cost of these women. But also, you know, I think that it's a shame that these women who have achieved so much are still getting this feedback that their accomplishments are not enough, that their gender is holding them back. And even, you know, that's not anything about them, that it's about other people, and that's still happening at these highest levels of leadership.
Mm-hmm. Karen, I wonder if we can broaden the conversation, as we've got a couple minutes here left, with your position there at the CAT Center at ISU. How do you keep track of and how much progress have we made in terms of gender diversity in leadership positions, be that in the military and elected officials and so forth? Where are we?
Well, that's a great question, and what it, the answer is that in the United States is that we're making slow but steady progress. So, you know, with the number of women in state legislatures, or the number of women CEOs, or the number of women in Congress, we're at record highs, but the percentages are still low, especially in comparison to the fact that women are over half of the population. And one of the things that, you know, slows women's progress is that as women have run for office or have, you know, entered into positions of leadership, when they step down or retire or move on to different offices, they're not replaced by women, right? They are, many times they are replaced by men. So there's there is no sort of conversion of a seat to become a woman's seat. And so that means that there's just very, very slow progress, and that there are continue to be barriers to women's advancement for a variety of reasons. We could do a whole show on that.
Right. And we've spoken about her before, but Kamala Harris, now 1 month approximately as the first female vice president in our country's history. The normalizing.
It's remarkable.
The normalizing of having a woman in that office is, and talk about that for a minute or so, about what the implications of that are.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things, and the vice presidency is one of the clearest paths to the presidency. When we look historically at what offices have qualified people that have then sought and secured the presidency, Donald Trump is somebody who's never held political office is a huge outlier. Usually it's Senate, governor, or vice president, or even more than one of those positions. And so, you know, with her background and her resume, she will be well positioned to run for president and could, in fact, that glass ceiling as well.
Mm-hmm. Final comments from you, Megan, on your mind on this point or another point that you'll be watching in the coming days?
Yeah, I think everything Karen said is absolutely correct. And also that there is an important sort of trickle-down effect of having women in leadership is that it inspires young girls who are in high school or, you know, sort of at that important age for deciding what they want to do to run for office and to see that as attainable. And so the degree to which she is visible, and I think Biden has done a good job of sort of giving her the stage sometimes, the degree to which she's visible has a measurable impact later on, you know, down the road, how many women we have in office.
Mm-hmm. And we'll be hearing stories in years to come of witnessing the swearing in of Kamala Harris, and regardless of your partisan politics, of those young women, Karen, girls, young women, hearkening back to that moment as a life-changing moment, perhaps.
Yes. Oh, yes. I think there will be a lot of young girls who will point to that as being a pivotal event. And, you know, we saw a lot of women celebrating that moment with their choices of clothing. Right. You know, the pearls and the Chuck Todd sneakers were worn by women of all ages all around the country as a way of sort of celebrating Kamala Harris's inauguration and, you know, breaking yet another glass ceiling and making history.
Mm-hmm. Karen Kiedrowski, thank you so much. Of Iowa State University, Megan Goldberg of Cornell College, thank you for your insights this hour. Until next time.
Yes, thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.
Iowa Republican leaders encourage wearing a mask at the Capitol, but oppose making it a mandate.
We have no way to enforce that, even if we were to say everyone in the caucus has to have a mask.
This worries Democratic leaders.
I'm concerned and want to avoid, you know, turning the legislature into a super spreader event.
Legislative leaders share their goals and concerns, and so does the governor on the podcast Under the Golden Dome. Listen to the new episode now at iowapublicradio.org.